shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Trying to come up with new ideas is becoming quite a problem, because some of you have been coming for 10 years at least, and you've heard an awful lot of things during that time. And I don't want to go back over old ground unnecessarily. Something new came up to my attention, at least, hardly more than a week ago, that surprised me considerably. It has to do with one of the ancient countries, and yet it's startlingly modern because it shows one of the Bible's prophecies working out now, which I believe none of us had expected until at least into the time of the last great war. I want to talk to you about Egypt and about something that's happening there now that came about unexpectedly, and it shows that God can figure things out well ahead of us. We might as well get a little review on ancient Egypt. It's something that is hard to pin down exact dates on. The only, you might say, authentic history of Egypt was that written by an Egyptian priest about 250 B.C. named Manetho. And the difficulty is, no copy of Manetho's history exists. All we have of it are the fragmentary quotes in the works of some of the Greek historians, and they don't all quote it alike, so you do have problems. The origin of Egypt is lost in prehistoric legend. Long before there was one country, Egypt, there were settlements there of some substantial civilization. But they were scattered, a number of independent cities. Apparently, it was gathered together as one country by a king named Menes, who united it into the one nation of Egypt. And when Menes did that is something on which you can get quite a variety of dates. Some of the ancient historians give quotes, purportedly from Egyptian sources, of early dynasties going back over a period of some 36,500 B.C. The early kings of this dynasty, they say, were the gods. Now, that can be, of course, wholly fictitious, or it can have a partial basis in truth. Odin, who was worshipped as a god by the Scandinavians and Germans when they were pagan before Christianity reached them, we know is a real living person in his day. He was a Scythian chieftain who led his people from Scythia up into Denmark, and he is found in the family tree of George Washington. He was such a remarkable leader that in time they deified him. Now there can be some such background as that behind the Egyptian legends, but they're so lost in antiquity that we don't know whether it's a pure fiction evolved by the priests or whether they have simply very greatly exaggerated the dates. By sinking a shaft to a considerable depth, they have found Stone Age implements that can be reasonably reliably dated about 13,500 B.C. At that particular point, there is one of those huge statues that the Egyptian pharaohs like to put up in their own honor, and the soil has accumulated around the base of it to a depth of about 10 feet. That is, you have to dig down 10 feet to get to what was the original pavement around this statue. And judging by that rate of accumulation, where they found these remains of a late Stone Age culture would be about 13,500 BC. However, you do not find any evidence, historical or archaeological or of any kind, of a gradual rise of civilization in Egypt. It arrives suddenly. In other words, the evidence would indicate that an already highly civilized people from somewhere else moved in and settled there, bringing their own civilization with them. The Egyptian priests were their historians also. They kept the records, other than the king's official records of his reign, and they told some of the Greek historians who inquired about it that the Egyptians were survivors of the sinking of the lost continent of Atlantis and had made their way across North Africa and settled in Egypt. It's altogether possible because we can't find any other place to say they came from here. The first dynasty, beginning with Menes, according to some of the king lists, began as early as 5948 BC. Sir Flinders Petrie, one of the great authorities on Egyptology, gave a date of about 4777 BC. Later, that has been reduced to perhaps 3300 to 3000 BC. Among the self-admitted experts on the subject, there's a great tendency to believe that nothing could possibly be as old as the people who lived then say it was. Oh, lop off 1,000 years, seems to be their motto. So, we don't know. But you take the Great Pyramid, built in the time of the pharaoh Khufu, who was in the second dynasty, not the one established by Menes. Some authorities place his reign as about 3969 to 3908 BC. Others try to make it as late as, 2700 BC. The true date probably is between 3000 and 3300. The Egyptians, having started with a rather high type of monotheistic religion, became finally among the most debased of the pagans. They were animal worshippers. The sacred bull, Apis, was worshipped by them. Well, much on the order of the Hindus of today, worshipping the cow as a god. And if you have seen pictures of the various pagan gods worshipped by the Egyptians, you note that while they had human figures, they would have the head of a bird or a jackal or something of that sort. I guess a bird-brained god was sufficient for a bird-brained people. However, the earliest traces of Egyptian religion that can be found indicate monotheism of a rather high type. In fact, some of their hymns are surprisingly parallel to some of the Psalms in the Bible, showing that they started out with a very much higher religion than they finished up with. We get these early things from the fact that when we have been able to dig up the mummy cases of some of the early kings, or have found in some of the pyramids where they were buried. The Great Pyramid of Cheops was never a tomb and has no writing in it like the others have. But for those that were used as tombs, there were very extensive carvings in the passageways. Their theory was that the soul of the dead had to pass through a rather rigid examination to see whether he came to a good end or a bad one in the hereafter. And they were afraid that he might forget some of his lines. So these were put in his tomb in the passageways near it so he could refresh his memory as to what he was to say when examined. And in these, which go way back, dating back to the Second Dynasty, is found this rather elevated type of religion that soon thereafter disappears. The animal worship, many authorities say, was established by 4400 to 4300 BC. A great deal of work has been done on Egyptian history by David Davidson, who got out what I consider the only really authoritative work on the Great Pyramid. I think all of you know how the interior passages of the pyramid have been found to be prophetic. While indicating only in a vague general way, as a turn for the better or a turn for the worse, what the nature of the event will be, they do give very precise dates. And these have been found to correspond with the most important datings in the Bible. Now, it was simple enough for Davidson, taking the three most official surveys of the pyramid, to compute the dates represented by these different points in the pyramid. But the question was, when you had found that it gave a date of 1486 B.C., let us say, the question was, what actually happened in that particular year? So he had to unscramble ancient history. There was no corresponding system of dating among the ancients. In every country, the only dating system you had was that their records would show that something happened on the 8th day of the 5th month of the 22nd year of the reign of King so-and-so. And then when he died and another king succeeded him, you began with the first day of the first month of the first year of the reign of King somebody else. And of course, you had these different reigns of the different kings and the different nations, all starting at different times. Fortunately, you had two ways of tying them together. The records of Assyria, we'll say, would show that in a certain year of the reign of King so-and-so of Assyria, they were at war with Babylon. And the Babylonian records would show that that same war occurred in such a year of the reign of a certain Babylonian king. So you got the overlap of the two reigns established. Then, because of their superstition, practically all of them recorded eclipses, either of the sun or the moon. While eclipses occur every year, there may be a great many years between two successive eclipses visible at the same place. Astronomers can compute not only to the day, but to the hour, when a total eclipse of the sun, we'll say, was visible in Babylon. And since the historical records will give you an approximate time, so you know you're not dealing with some other century, when that's recorded as being on the evening of the 11th day of the 5th month of the 22nd year of the reign of King so-and-so, you can pinpoint it exactly right down to the day by the eclipses. So Davidson worked all this out with astronomical mathematics to pinpoint the days of the eclipses and checking up on the overlap of the records of the different kings' reigns, and then the works of the main ancient historians, while they didn't always agree with each other on everything, he was able to work out a complete and pretty accurate scheme of datings of ancient history. Now, with that, he could tell you then whether a particular pyramid date was really significant or not, because he could tell you what happened on that particular date. Davidson's datings would indicate the Great Pyramid was built somewhere in the period between 3500 and 2700 B.C. Now, there has been a legend, if you want to call it that. Nothing apparently is credited with being history unless it's written by some left-wing Jew at Harvard. The people who lived in the days when it actually happened and knew what they were writing about, well, that's legend, you understand. There has been a persistent legend that one of the men who directed the building of the Great Pyramid was the patriarch Enoch. Now, Enoch lived from 3382 to 3017 B.C. So that would be within the period when other indications show the Great Pyramid was built. Another thing on which there's the usual disagreement in dates, there was a people who came out of Arabia into Egypt and took over and ruled for a while, the Hyksos, the shepherd kings. As I say, the Egyptian pagan priests were the historians, and they have nothing good to say about these shepherd kings because it seems that they closed down all the pagan temples and insisted on the worship of just one god, which hurt the pagan priest's revenue no end, so you don't get anything good said about them. They ruled for a time principally in the northern or lower Egypt and eventually were driven out. Now, you get all sorts of dates from the so-called experts. Some of them say the shepherd kings were there as much as a trifle over 500 years. Others say only very slightly over 100. The most accurate records that we can get would indicate that they were there about 350 years, from 1937 to 1587 B.C. Joseph, one of the patriarchs of Israel, was sold into slavery in Egypt in 1729 B.C. And this, as you can see, was when the shepherd kings were ruling. They weren't technically Israelites, but they were an Adamic people, closely related to the Israelites, and the favor with which Joseph was received and made first assistant to the Pharaoh, prime minister, is something that is understandable when it came within the reign of these shepherd kings, when it wouldn't have been understandable in the reign of the ordinary native Egyptian pharaohs. The pharaoh Thutmes III, who reigned from 1744 to 1690 B.C., was evidently the pharaoh who promoted Joseph to the position of prime minister. His records from his 21st to his 42nd year of his reign, inclusive, show constant warfare. But from the 43rd to the 49th years, inclusive, there was no record of any military adventures. Now, this was that 7 years period of famine that the Bible records, which had been prophesied to him by Joseph, and he had his hands full keeping his people contented enough that they wouldn't throw him out. So the idea of running around elsewhere to make military conquests was out of the question. In 1698 B.C., his records show that he ordered extensive dredging of the Nile River at the first cataract. The headwaters of the Nile come way back in Ethiopia and perhaps a little to the west of Ethiopia. There are three principal rivers which have their start in high snow-covered mountains. These finally join to form the Nile, and it flows from Ethiopia down through the Sudan, which in the ancient days they called Nubia, down through Egypt and into the Mediterranean Sea. The southerly border of Egypt itself, at modern Aswan, the first cataract of the Nile, that was quite an important point. There's nothing but utterly barren desert, both to the east and the west of this narrow Nile Valley. The only place that invasion could come from the south would be along the Nile Valley, because there's simply nothing to eat and nothing to drink on either side of it. So the Egyptians, from early days, had put heavy fortifications at the first cataract of the Nile. It's spoken of in the Bible a time or two as the Tower of Syene, which was at the first cataract, Assuan, you still find carved in the rocks there the markings where the Egyptians kept records of how high the Nile River rose in flood time. When the extensive snow fields in these mountain ranges where the Nile began, when these snow fields were melted by the coming of spring, the river, which had gone down considerably before that, the river was raised to flood height by all this water coming through. And since the river was a matter of life or death to Egypt, they soon learned to keep a careful watch on it. In years when the water was low, it was important to let every drop through. On those occasions, the old Egyptian records show, the kings would order extensive dredging so that the channels wouldn't be blocked and hold the water back where it could percolate out into the desert on either side. So you find the Egyptian records entirely corroborating what the Bible tells you about the 7 years of famine that Joseph had prophesied and told the Pharaoh to prepare for. These shepherd kings were expelled, finally, in 1587 B.C. The Bible tells you, Exodus 1, verse 8, "Now there rose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph, and that, as far as we can determine, was Ramesu the second." The Egyptian form of the name is Ramesu, but you generally see it in the Grecianized form Ramesses, because, as I say, we've been getting this thing through Herodotus' story of what Manetho told him. It's my fervent hope that for the early Greek historians there is some superheated sub-basement of hell, because it was one of the primary articles of faith of these Greek historians that you must never, never, under any circumstances, when you describe one of these ancient kings, use his correct name or anything near enough to it to be recognized. And there isn't a one of these Egyptian pharaohs that Herodotus talks about that he gives a name that bears the slightest resemblance to the man's Egyptian name, as we find from the Egyptian records. And it's caused no end of confusion in trying to work this out. Ramesu was the pharaoh of the oppression, the one in whose court Moses lived. Now, Moses was born in 1566 B.C., and he was aged 80 at the date of the Exodus, 1486 B.C. Ramesu II was dead at the time of the Exodus. You remember that Moses, while he lived the life of an adopted member of the royal family of Egypt for a while, finally had to flee for his life way over into Midian in Babylonia until that pharaoh died. And the one who was on the throne at the time of the Exodus was Menephtah. The Egyptian records confirm 1486 B.C. as being the year of the Exodus of the Israelites out of Egypt. From early times, you have a great kingdom and a great empire in Egypt. The first few dynasties, the Egyptians were a peaceable people who stayed at home, weren't trying to go out and conquer their neighbors. They really developed an amazingly high civilization for its day, higher than any of the other empires of their date. Later, they became like the other empires. They were governed by pharaohs whose vanity couldn't allow them to see any people anywhere that they didn't rule over. And so you had them, like the other empires, embroiled in perpetual wars of conquest, or defending themselves against some other nation's wars of conquest. The at various times, extended their empire as far as the Euphrates River. The city of Carchemish on the Euphrates River marked the eastern boundary of Egypt a good deal of the time. Now, during this period, at least the ruling class, and as far as we know, all of the Egyptians, were as white a people as any that you can find any trace of, either in early times or now. We think mostly of sculpture as being the great work of the Greeks. But as a matter of fact, the Greeks left us very few portrait sculptures. The Greek sculptures that we have were the artist's idea of what a handsome person should look like. Not any one person. In fact, it's well known that many of their principal statues were made with one person serving as a model for the head and somebody else for the chest and arms and somebody else for the rest of the figure and so on. And in fact, if you have seen pictures of many of the famous Greek sculptures, you will note that the face is a blank expression of total stupidity. They didn't indicate the pupil of the eye. So there's this blank, unseeing stare. You find nothing corresponding to that among the Egyptians, and for a good reason. The Egyptians, starting with their monotheistic religion in the early days and carrying the idea down through their paganism, the Egyptians believed in resurrection. But there had to be something to resurrect. That's why they mummified the corpses of their people, at least those who could afford it, so that there would still remain a body. They didn't know how far in the future this day of resurrection would be. So they mummified it in the hopes they could keep the body still intact, ready to be resurrected. And they realized that the best of their mummification processes wouldn't last forever, and they didn't know how long it would have to be. With any Egyptian who was well-to-do enough to afford it, in his tomb there was a portrait sculpture of the man. It didn't have to be life-size, but it was a portrait sculpture of him, so that if the mummy disintegrated too badly, the soul could go into this statue and live there until the time came for resurrection. Now, there'd be no use in putting a statue of somebody else in the tomb. That wouldn't do you any good. So it was a portrait of the individual. And probably no time in antiquity ever produced such remarkably fine portrait sculptures as the early days in Egypt. If you met one of those people walking down the street after you had seen that portrait sculpture, you'd recognize him without any question. Now, they were such realists that they also painted these statues. And where it has remained sealed in a tomb until opened recently so that weather couldn't disintegrate the paint, why, the paint on it is still good. Now, they were so painstakingly accurate. The men, of course, would work out in the fields, superintending their slaves working in the fields. So the men naturally got suntanned to a degree. So the statues of the men had a slightly darker suntan complexion than the statues of the women, who spent their time mostly in the house, out of the hot Egyptian sunlight. Now, both the features, the narrow-bridged nose, the thin lips, the general cast of the face, show that you had a very definitely white race, as well as the complexion indicated by the painting of the statue. So all the days of Egypt's grandeur, Egypt was in Africa, but don't ever think of it as Negroid, because in that period of time, there was the death penalty for any free Negro found north of the first cataract of the Nile, that is, within the boundaries of Egypt. Now, they did have a trading post established just slightly within the boundary, and they would let Egyptians come there with their furs and that sort of thing to trade. But down really into Egypt proper, any Negro who wasn't a slave in chains was simply summarily killed on sight. So don't let anybody ever tell you that Egypt is an indication of a high Negroid civilization. There never was one. What today we call the Sudan, the area lying between Egypt and Ethiopia proper, in those days they called Nubia. In the first place, of course, the Egyptian army repelled raids by the Nubian Negroes. Then, getting tired of that, they went down and conquered Nubia and took a lot of the Nubian Negroes as slaves. Now, you remember that Rome, in the days when her own people made up the Roman army, Rome conquered substantially all the then known world. And then, as they began degenerating, they didn't have the hardihood to serve in their army, so they began getting mercenary troops from the so-called barbarians, until the barbarians finally got tired of defending a people who had degenerated till they were no longer capable of defending themselves, and the barbarians began plundering Rome themselves. Well, the Egyptians began doing the same thing. They were becoming too civilized to serve in the Egyptian army. So, here were a lot of big husky Negroes down in Nubia. So they began training them for soldiers. As long as you had enough Egyptian officers among them to keep control of them, that did serve a purpose. Remember that in those days you had no complicated weapons that required intelligence to use. All you had were bows and arrows and spears, and the Nubian natives at least knew what to do with a spear. Among all these ancient kingdoms, there was always a period of unrest and uncertainty when the reigning king died. Sometimes his eldest son was still fairly young. Any usurper who could get the support of a substantial part of the army might be able to move in and take over the throne. So, in Egypt, since that did happen on a few occasions, they developed the system that during the last years of the reign of any pharaoh, from the time that his oldest son grew old enough to be trained in taking the responsibility of the kingdom, you had a joint rule, a co-regency, so that for some years, the army was accustomed to taking orders from the crown prince, and it wasn't a brand new idea when his father died and he succeeded to the throne and told them, you put down any uprisings. But back somewhere around 775 BC, when the reigning pharaoh died, the Egyptian governor of Nubia knew that as far as Egypt was concerned, there wasn't much of an army there. Down in Nubia, he had the best trained troops that there were. So he swiftly marched north into Egypt with his Nubian Negro army and took over. This was the 25th Egyptian dynasty. And for a period of about 75 or 80 years, you had these Nubian Negroes ruling Egypt. And, of course, that was the worst disaster possible, because you know what these Nubian Negro troops did with the Egyptian women. They were the military masters of the land. And in that period, Egypt became a mulatto nation. And that was the end of the greatness of Egypt. As the Bible said, they became the basest of all the kingdoms. And they have been ever since. Egyptian architecture, Egyptian art, everything declined badly. Remember, the northern kingdom of Israel, the 10-tribed kingdom, was conquered by Assyria between 740 and 721 BC. So you can see that this was during the period when this Nubian Negro dynasty was in control of Egypt. The power of Assyria, back in the Tigris-Euphrates valleys, the power of Assyria had been rising during that period. And the Assyrians never did have much ability at anything except conquering their neighbors. They were quite a good parallel to the Turks in later times. They were a military people, perhaps even more so than the Romans. And they conquered their neighbors and looted them and made slaves of many of them. Here you had this problem. Every little kingdom, if it only covered 200 or 300 square miles, had the idea it wanted to be an empire and conquer some smaller neighboring kingdom that only covered 120 square miles. Every kingdom was in constant peril of attack by its neighbors. Not only the northern kingdom of Israel, but the southern kingdom of Judah were constantly in peril of efforts of the kingdom of Syria to the north and northeast to conquer them. Whenever they retained their loyalty to Yahweh God, they had no trouble with attacks by their neighbors. Most of the time they lived in peace, because when they were attacked, they inflicted such crushing defeats upon these other kingdoms that they weren't in a hurry to come back and make another attack. But when they lapsed into idolatry, as you remember they did about once every generation, then they were subject to attacks by the Edomites on the southeast and by the Syrians on the north and northeast. Under those circumstances, being idolaters, they didn't ask help from God. They sought help in military alliances with their neighbors. Egypt, if it was an attack by Syria, or even Assyria, if it was an attack by Edom or Egypt to the south. During this period, when Egypt now was ruled by these Nubian pharaohs, you will read in Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, the warnings that against the threatening power of Assyria, it was so stupid to try to gain help by alliances with Egypt, because you couldn't rely upon Egypt. And that was true. The greatness of Egypt in every respect had passed. Now in this period, you begin finding a number of prophecies in the Bible about disasters that were to come upon Egypt. God's patience with Egypt had worn pretty thin by this time. Now, some of these prophecies refer to the conquest of Egypt by Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. Ezekiel 29, 30, and 31, even the first part of Ezekiel chapter 32, belong to this group. Then you'll find some others that refer to conquests by Assyria and by the Persians. You remember the order was the Assyrian Empire was superseded by Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar, and that finally was overthrown by the Medo-Persian Empire. These prophecies against Egypt have to be studied in the light of ancient history to note to which they refer. For example, Ezekiel 29, verses 10 and 11. Behold, I am against thee and against thy rivers, and I will make the land of Egypt utterly waste and desolate, from the Tower of Syene even unto the border of Ethiopia. No foot of man shall pass through it, nor foot of beast shall pass through it, neither shall it be inhabited 40 years. Well, now we know that didn't happen to Egypt proper, and the description here is not that of Egypt proper. The Tower of Syene is at Aswan, the southern border of Egypt itself, and says from there to Ethiopia. So that is clearly the Sudan, as we call it today, ancient Nubia. It no doubt refers to conditions following the defeat of this 25th dynasty, either by the Assyrians under Esarhaddon, that was about 670 B.C., or possibly by the Persians under Cambyses in 525 B.C., or under Xerxes in 483 B.C. But there are some others that refer to a later, greater event that has never been fulfilled in the past. And the entire 19th chapter of Isaiah refers to this. Everybody that I know of who has been a student of prophecy, myself included, has thought that this 19th chapter of Isaiah wasn't going to come into effect until this final war that closes this age. In other words, the times of the 38th and 39th chapters of Ezekiel. And it has sneaked up on us and happened in a way that none of us anticipated. Not from warfare at all, but from what was intended as the most peaceable sort of thing. And that's what I want to talk to you about tonight, because the fact that the prophecies of the 19th chapter of Ezekiel have actually been fulfilled to the greater part in the last few years show us just how close to the end we are. This 19th chapter of Isaiah has, of course, like nearly everything else in the King James Version, been garbled somewhat by the translators, and I'll make a correction or two from some other translations as we go. Mostly I'm taking it from the King James Version because that's what you'll find at home. The burden of Egypt. Behold, Yahweh rides upon a swift cloud and shall come into Egypt, and the idols of Egypt shall be moved at his presence. And the heart of Egypt shall melt in the midst of it. And I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians, and they shall fight every one against his brother, and every one against his neighbor. They have had periods of internal warfare like that in the past, between different people fighting for the throne. But that's apparently not what it's referring to here. And the spirit of Egypt shall fail in the midst thereof. And I will destroy the counsel thereof, and they shall seek to the idols and to the charmers and to them that have familiar spirits and wizards. And the Egyptians will I give over into the hand of a cruel lord, and a fierce king shall rule over them, saith Yahweh of hosts. And the waters shall fail from the sea, and the rivers shall be wasted and dried up. That doesn't make too good sense, because you'd have to use up a lot of water not to have it in the sea. It's notable that the Septuagint translation, when they translated the Old Testament into Greek about 250 B.C., gives that verse this way. It's Isaiah 19, verse 5. The Egyptians drink water, even that near the sea, but the rivers shall fail and be dried up. That they'll be reduced to using the brackish water close to the mouth of the river. Then, the next verse, 6, garbled, as we shall see, and they shall turn the rivers far away. And your King James Version says, in the brooks of defense, a meaningless phrase, obviously garbled, the brooks of defense shall be emptied and dried up, and the reeds and flags shall wither. Now, the Septuagint and Moffat's modern English translation, instead of the brooks of defense, say the canals. That would make sense, because from ancient times, irrigation has been necessary in the Nile Valley. The fishers also, fishermen that is, shall mourn, and all they that cast hook into the brook shall lament, and they that spread nets upon the waters shall languish. Way back in the Upper Sudan, there is a place where the Nile River flows through a rather shallow valley, and it comes to a place where it's cut its way through a great dike of rock, so that there is a place where it's flowing through a narrow pass with rock cliffs on either side. A carload of explosives could blast down enough rocks from those cliffs to make a dam in this narrow spot and halt the flow there. And if it rose not too far in this shallow valley, it would overflow over the low hills to the east of it and cut itself a new channel heading down east into the Red Sea. You remember that because of the Suez Canal, Egypt has been in important defense base for England. You remember how desperately they were worried when the German general Rommel almost captured Egypt. Now, the Italians had taken Eritrea, the coastal portion of Ethiopia, back between World Wars I and II, and had even pretty much captured Ethiopia. They hadn't been able to prevent guerrilla warfare in the jungle portions of it, but they were occupying it and in general command. And there was quite a bit of nervousness during World War II that the Italians might go back there, blast those cliffs down, and block the Nile, which would have made Egypt uninhabitable and driven the British out. So that was the natural interpretation to put upon this thing. And that's what, as I say, all of us expected, and it didn't happen. And it never dawned upon us how it would sneak up on us in another way. Moreover, they that work in combed flax and they that weave cotton shall be ashamed. Now, there's some more here where the King James Version has garbled it a bit. Verse 10, and they shall be broken in the purposes thereof, all that make sluices and ponds for fish. Now, that's about as silly a statement as you'd find anywhere, isn't it? And whenever you find something that the translators have turned silly, you know it wasn't in the original. It's a mistake of translation. I happen to have, among the many different translations in my library, a translation of the Old Testament put out by the Jews, Jewish Publication Society of America, in Philadelphia. And oddly enough, they have gotten the translation of this particular verse that makes more sense than any of the others, as we shall see. This verse 10, by the way, because it is so stupid in the King James Version, and most of the other translators can't seem to make anything better out of it, you'll find many of the modern English translations simply leave it out. They don't even put in an asterisk to indicate something's left out. They just ignore it. Here's what the Jewish translation says, and you'll appreciate how keenly perceptive it is when I tell you what I have learned recently. And her foundations shall be crushed. All they that make dams shall be grieved and sorrow. Then it goes on, surely the princes of Zoan are fools. The council of the wise counselors of Pharaoh has become brutish. How say ye unto Pharaoh, I am the son of the wise, the son of ancient kings. Where are they? Where are thy wise men? And let them tell thee now, and let them know what Yahweh of hosts has purposed upon Egypt. The princes of Zoan are become fools. The princes of Noph are deceived. They have also deceived Egypt, even they that are the stay of the tribes thereof. Yahweh has mingled a perverse spirit in the midst thereof, and they have caused Egypt to err in every work thereof, as a drunken man staggers in his vomit. Neither shall there be any work for Egypt, which the head or tail, branch or rush may do. In that day shall Egypt be like unto women, and it shall be afraid and fear, because of the shaking of the hand of Yahweh of hosts, which he shakes over it. And the land of Judah shall be a terror unto Egypt. Note the peculiar accuracy of that. It doesn't say the people of Judah, because these Jews over there in Palestine are not any of them from the tribe of Judah. The land of Judah shall be a terror unto Egypt. Everyone that makes mention thereof shall be afraid in himself, because of the counsel of Yahweh of hosts, which he has determined against it. No doubt you have read that until recent times, relatively, go back not more than a century, until recent times, the valley of the Nile was considered the most fertile soil in the world, because every year at the flood season, the land was so low, so little above the level of normal level of the river, at the flood season, the waters overflowed the farmland. They did two things. One was, in this 2 or 3 months that the land was flooded, all the salt and alkali that had been accumulating in the soil was leached out of it and washed away down to the sea. In the Salt River Valley in Arizona, city of Phoenix is in that valley, about 800 years ago, the Indians had a surprisingly high civilization there. They irrigated a great area with the waters of the Salt River. As a matter of fact, the modern irrigation system has mostly just deepened the remains of the old Indian canals. They were that well engineered. But what happened was this. The water put upon the land dissolved any alkali or salt that was in the soil and brought it to the surface. Now, in that hot, dry climate, there was no runoff. The water simply came to the surface and evaporated into the air. So it was constantly dissolving and bringing to the surface the alkali and salt, and then leaving it there. And over a period of time, the salt and the alkali accumulated to the point where they could no longer raise any crops. It destroyed the fertility of the soil, and the Indians were starved out about 800 years ago. Now, the same thing could happen anyplace else in the world. But it couldn't happen in the Nile Valley because every year the floodwaters of the Nile flushed out any alkali or salt that had been accumulating in the upper part of the soil. Then the next thing, there are three principal rivers that are the source of the Nile. The Blue Nile, the White Nile, and one which is known as the Black Nile, because flowing through an area in Ethiopia where there is a good deal of silty soil, it picks up so much silt that the waters are just almost black with it. The flow of the Nile brings down this silt, and in that 3 months that the Nile Valley in Egypt is covered with the floodwaters, it drops another layer of this fresh silt on it. The soil is constantly being replenished. So it had the reputation of being the most fertile soil in the world. Then back, I forget the date, but say 60, 70 years ago, something like that, the British built for them a low dam at Assouan. You know, we're always trying to improve on nature. This was to hold back the flood water so they wouldn't have to vacate their farmlands part of the year. Then they raised it a bit. Then the Egyptians, getting delusions of grandeur, said, "We want a great high dam at Assouan. It'll store vast quantities of water so that even in the driest years, we always have ample water there to draw on." Well, our own government, eager to give away billions of dollars of the American taxpayers' money, volunteered to do it. Then, when Egypt showed a dislike for having her territory taken away by the Jews, the American government reneged on its promise to build for the Egyptians the high dam. So the Russians stepped in, and they offered to go through with it. And the Russians did build that high dam. So you have a great high dam at Assouan holding back the waters of the Nile. Then they release it in just the quantities they want. A river flowing along rapidly carries with it any silt it has picked up. And when you hold it back behind a dam and the water comes to a halt, all that silt drops out. For one thing, it starts silting up the reservoir behind the dam. You're constantly building up the bottom of it higher and higher with the silt that's dropped there. And secondly, no silt gets down below that dam. For some years now, the farm fields of Egypt have never been covered by the annual flood. The annual flood never gets by the high Assouan dam. It's begun to show up. The most important crop in Egypt is the cotton crop. Their cotton crop is falling off badly because the soil is becoming alkaline. It never gets the floodwaters to leach it out. And in that hot Egyptian climate, the water they put on it by irrigation through the canals, of course, it dissolves The alkali in the lower depths of the soil brings it to the surface, evaporates, and leaves it there. You're having the same thing that happened in our Salt River Valley of Arizona 800 years ago. Let's go back and look at Isaiah again. Moreover, they that work in combed flax and they that weave cotton shall be ashamed. They do, of course, have some flax or linen farming, but principally cotton. And both of them are getting into difficulties. Now, another thing, when it comes to fish, you don't start with whales and work from them down to the smaller things. You start to begin with what is called plankton, P-L-A-N-K-T-O-N, which includes tiny little living things so small as to be bacteria and a bit larger up to things that are visible to the eye if you look closely. Then the smallest little minnows feed upon the plankton, and somewhat larger fish feed on the minnows, and the bigger fish feed on those, and so on. They had quite a fishing industry in the lower reaches of the Nile and at the mouth of the Nile. The start of the food cycle for fish, the plankton, was what washed down with silt, and it doesn't come anymore. And you've cut off the food chain right at the start of it. Not being the little minnows to feed the larger fish aren't there. So their fishing industry has gone bad. And remember, Egypt desperately needs anything she can get to bring in any kind of income. The fishers shall mourn, and all they that cast hook into the brooks shall lament, and they that spread nets upon the waters shall languish. And as I say, this sneaked up on us until just recently has it come to light. So the Egyptians are in desperate trouble. We were all waiting for the next war, the final Armageddon war, to bring this about through turning the river away way back in the Sudan. That wasn't the way God had planned it. It didn't take a war to do it. When we're into this point, you can see that prophecy being fulfilled shows us we're getting close to the time of the end. So take note that things are shaping up rapidly for the end. You may not have too long to wait.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.